Hello and welcome to another edition of Big Mouth, where we throw pop culture into a large hadron collider of criticism and then we analyse all the little broken up particles that are left. My name's Andrew Harrison, and as ever we have two special guests today. Kate Mossman is a noted writer and broadcaster and also arts editor of The New Statesman. She is a graduate of The Word magazine, where she cut her teeth on the review section. She's also presented the very well received BBC documentary When Pop Ruled My Life, which looked at the obsessive relationship between fans and bands. Kate herself is obsessed with Queen, and her dad edits Potato Review magazine, the essential resource for the professional potato grower. Hello, Kate. How are you?
Hello, I'm very well.
I'm glad to see that you're in fine fettle. Have you ever pitched a Potatoes in Rock feature to your dad?
No, he gets a lot of suggestions for, you know, people wanting to run recipe features and things like that, but it's much more along the science journal lines. So it's Blight and things, and GM.
Blight and GM. Yeah. So you've not suggested Hot Chip, King Edward's Magic Theatre, Maris Piper at the Gates of Dawn? None of these have been suggested?
He's been saving those up.
Yeah, he's looking for a new direction at the moment. So
Cypress Hill, excellent, yes. I noticed that in this month's issue, one feature is Understanding Varietal Susceptibility to Common Scab.
That sounds perfect.
I think I saw Common Scab at the Powerhouse in 1992.
See, I thought that was a Redskins track on the B-sides of Levi Bronston's Army.
Yes. Put an end to Common Scab. Also joining us in the underground Big Mouth bunker this week is David Stubbs, Melody Maker veteran, contributor to The Guardian and When Saturday Comes. David is the author of the acclaimed book Future Days, Krautrock and the Building of Modern Germany, a scholarly but highly readable account of the birth of Germany's first indigenous rock and roll sound. He's also known as Mr. Agreeable, Melody Maker's famously abusive columnist. And he's a massive Arsenal fan. Hello, David.
Indeed.
How are you?
Well, indeed, yeah. Fine. Thank you very much.
Jolly good. Did you know that there is actually a breed of potato called Arsenal?
I did not.
I looked it up.
I'll seek it out.
I looked it up on the potato site, and it says dormancy medium, which I don't know what that means. It says something to do with arson. Who knows?
I think you know everything about potatoes. That's the thing about them, is a vegetable, isn't it?
It is, yes.
But I'm hesitant. It is a vegetable, isn't it? It's not like...
strictly speaking, is it a tuber?
Like whales not being fish.
Does that count? It's a tuber.
Does a tuber count as a vegetable?
Maybe dormancy means how long it takes to grow.
Doesn't count as a vegetable for dietary purposes, I think, usually.
No, it's the one to avoid. Yeah.
It is one of your five a day, but they say don't eat too many of them.
Don't eat three of them.
People just eat chips, don't they? Anyway, you're listening to the Potato Podcast Big Mouth. With us, as ever, the sensible Sergeant Wilson to my Captain Mannering.
I really thought you were going to say Mr. Potato Head there, so thanks for that.
He's in charge of the sound. It's Matt Hall. Hello, Matt.
Hello, Andrew.
Okay, as we descend into the living hell of the EU referendum, this week UKIP were told to stop playing the theme from the Great War movie The Great Escape at their campaign events. The sons of composer Elmer Bernstein say our father would never have allowed UKIP to use his music. He would have strongly opposed the party's nativism and thinly disguised bigotry. Bernstein died in 2004, aged 82, and the rights to the song are now owned by Sony ATV, so there's not a lot they can do about it. At the same time, Neil Young has admitted defeat and says he'll allow Donald Trump to carry on using Rocket in the Free World as a campaign song, even though Young himself is a Bernie Sanders supporter. So does this matter? Should we get all het up when a politician uses music for their own purposes? Are we just getting annoyed when one of their gang takes something that belongs to our gang? Before we talk it over, let's have a listen to Elmer Bernstein's theme from The Great Escape. Great Escape theme by Elmer Bernstein. Kate, are you ready to go all Brexit after hearing that? Is your patriotic blood up?
Well, I think the problem with this is that this will always happen because rock music, particularly, uses this exactly the same kind of nebulous, inspirational vocab as politics does.
Yes.
So that's why you always find, particularly in America, like, you know, Springsteen and Jackson Brown get really annoyed when they find their songs have been used. And a few years ago, I was reviewing a Bon Jovi album. Mm-hmm. And I'm just going to read out some titles now. So half of these titles are Bon Jovi songs, and half of them are US presidential campaigns. Okay. Something to Believe, Believe in America, Made in America, Another Reason to Believe, A Stronger America, Forward, Undivided, The Distance, Change, Bring It On, and We Can Do Better.
I wouldn't like to guess which one.
You can't guess, exactly.
I like the idea of Believe in America, like it might be imaginary.
I think that may have been an Obama, and Something to Believe In was Bon Jovi or vice versa. But it always reminds me of it just seems such a strange thing that to me that they find out their songs are being used
yes.
after they've already been signed away. So how does that actually work on a kind of legal level? How come all these poor rock stars are going like, oh, well, God, apparently Romney's going around?
I'm slightly confused about that as well, because if you want to use a piece of music in a film or a TV programme, you have to contact the rights holders. And normally, if the composer is alive, then they kind of have to contact the composer as well. So I don't understand why...
This keeps happening.
Well, presumably because for live events,
well, there
are different rules.
But there's certainly a case that there's a bit of trolling going on here. And we'll just play it in front of 20,000 Trump supporters and then dare Neil Young or REM or whomever to complain about it. And then it becomes... Then the story snowballs even further because
maybe.
Hollywood is trying to silence us,
but
and Hollywood
likes
America and so forth.
But I do like the idea of Brexit using a piece of music written about... an event in a war to combat small-minded nationalism
yes.
by a man whose parents were immigrants
yes.
into America, who was investigated by the House of Un-American Activities
yes.
Committee and ended up kind of having to write songs for kind of things like theme tunes for, I think, films called Robot Dog and stuff like that, because he couldn't get work.
So what you're saying is they haven't really done the background check well, on this yeah. one.
Does that matter? I don't
but
know.
But it doesn't, because they're using it because it would be great to escape from the EU. Yeah.
They'd rather think
it's used by England fans. It's a constant refrain at England yes. games. And so I think those are the two simple reasons why it's used.
Well, I was about to ask you, David. I mean, the Great Escape theme has been absolutely ruined by football, hasn't it? Particularly by the appalling England supporters.
Well, it doesn't even make sense in the context of, yeah. sort of England, you know, being 5-0 up against Andorra and then suddenly... done, chaps.
Yes. Well, it sort of makes sense if you're 2-0 down in extra time and you want to kind of gee up the team
yeah.
for some sort of emotional moment. But to start playing it the minute after kickoff and play nothing else
yes,
for the entire
yes,
game.
There's no relation to the actual drama or the situation of the game. No, absolutely.
Plus the fact that I haven't seen The Great Escape for ages, since about kind of like Easter Bank Holiday 1986 or something, last time it was on kind of terrestrial TV. Mm. But wasn't it a huge failure? Didn't most of the people in The Great Escape, most of the people who escaped, end up getting kind of shot or
slum back in the chokey?
Yeah,
yeah.
Or in Donald Pleasance's case, going blind in the middle of a market somewhere in downtown
Can
Munich.
Can you get around this problem of musicians getting annoyed that their songs are being used by using those weird copyright free versions you used to hear in Little Chef in the 1980s?
Or the Top of the Pops
type
versions.
Yes,
yeah. Yes, absolutely. Yeah,
or they just transpose a couple of notes to make it sound kind of strange and odd.
Yeah.
They use something like that. But I entirely agree with that, Kate. I think the fault lies with rock stars who are being so deliberately kind of wussy and nebulous in terms of, like, you know, they're kind of purported to be kind of radical or whatever, but they're really not prepared. I mean, the classic example of this is John Lennon with Revolution.
Yeah.
And Count Me Out. Like wanting to have it both ways or whatever, wanting, you know, being so non-committal, or making statements that sound kind of grand and revolutionary but are impossible to disagree with. Big Country, I remember one time, and Stuart Adamson, who was on stage, bless him, and he said, "This song's for everyone who believes that everyone should have a fair chance."
Who wouldn't believe that? Springsteen, you know, the values of homecoming and family and being in your own backyard, he's a Democrat, but they are directly the kind of values
absolutely,
that Republicans can
see. Where is the music for those of us who hate our families and our hometowns? Where are our records?
I mean, unless you're going to be specific, and I mean, songs called, like, you know, "We specifically believe in the revolutionary overthrow of the capitalist system." That's the title. I mean, or like pop music, you know, the pop group, "For How Long Must We Tolerate Mass Murder? We Are All Prostitutes." I mean, you know...
You mentioned the Redskins earlier, and there is the faction who are knocking around now who are carrying that banner, and their songs tend to be called things like, you know, "Expropriate the Capitalists Now" and "Towards Full Socialism by This Time Next Year."
Yeah.
And it's difficult to make it scan, but you can't fault them for being straightforward.
Or they could take a cue from the world of boxing. Now, Mike Tyson, in 1988, I believe it was, he came on against this guy called Michael Spinks for his heavyweight title defence to a tune by Coil, who is kind of very
outside
of lefty alternative.
I thought you were going to say "Mama Said Knock You Out."
No. But, you know, this sort of throwing gristle grinding. It's an astonishing thing if you check it on YouTube, and it just sort of fills the room with this kind of ominous kind of avant-garde clangor. And he goes in and he slaughters Michael Spinks in 90 seconds, quite possibly impelled by the extraordinary choice.
I hope he didn't do anything else that Coil come in using to Michael Spinks after he defeated him, because they were a funny old band,
Coil. They were a funny old band, yes.
Well, anyway, from Americans with weird hair, strange politics and a terrible taste in music, to Moby, who this week publishes an actually rather excellent and very enjoyable autobiography, Porcelain tells the story of 10 entertainingly squalid years in his life in the 1990s, from actual poverty when he was living with his single-parent mum on a shoestring in Connecticut, to falling for straight-edge punk, veganism and Christianity, to moving to New York and discovering the nascent rave scene, which will go on to change his life. We'll talk about Porcelain and the pros and cons of rock autobiography in a minute, but first, here is Moby's breakthrough tune from 1991. This is Go. Well, it's hands in the air and the studio is thick with the aroma of Vicks VapoRub. That was Moby with Go from 1991. And we're discussing Moby's autobiography, Porcelain, with our special guests David Stubbs and Kate Mossman. Did we like it? David, did you enjoy the book?
Yeah, I really did, actually. For various reasons. I mean, for one thing, it's fabulously written. It's wonderfully kind of self-deprecating. You really just seem very kind of antithetical to the kind of average rock star in those particular terms. I mean, he has a real kind of good reading on, for instance, you know, the kind of faint kind of hypocrisy and sanctimoniousness of the reasons that he first embraced Christianity. He's extremely frank about his love life. He's an incredibly highly sexed individual. It also conveys fabulously what New York used to be like in the kind of, you know, 80s, 90s, and it really was a genuine and much more, I mean, Manhattan is a very kind of sanitized, slightly kind of postmodern sort of cupcakey version of itself now, but it genuinely was a really sort of scary, funky, dangerously funky sort of place, actually.
There are great scenes where he's pushing his records home from a gig on a skateboard.
Exactly, yes.
And it just feels like he's walking through the valley of death.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. And I think also with what's great about it is there's a sense of a sort of three-act drama. You know, there's like the first act and go. And then there's this sort of terrible decline that he has when he puts out the album Animal Rights. Mm. He decides, perversely, just at the time when techno is beginning to kind of become popular, to make this kind of sort of hardcore punk album. And I have a tiny walk-on park in Moby's life in this respect. When you referred earlier on to my character, Mr. Agreeable, this kind of weakly kind of vituperative character who just, you know, and I got a desperate call from Moby's press officer at the time because they couldn't get anybody to interview him. They couldn't get, you know, he just absolutely could not get arrested. They brought him over and they got no interviews on the schedule. And he rang me up and he said, David, do you think that Mr. Agreeable could interview Moby in character? Oh, you what? And honestly, it'd be quite fun. You know, and it's just like, no, I don't think so. It's like being interviewed by Basil Brush or something. It demeans us all. You know, it demeans Moby, it demeans me, it demeans Mr. Agreeable. No, I don't think so. I just couldn't agree with it. But that is how the nadir that he'd reach. And then, of course, he puts together Play, which is supposed to be almost like this kind of valedictory kind of thing, you know, bringing together all the sad forces of his life and his mum having died. And, of course, it's enormous. And then he's kind of elevated into the sort of stratosphere in which he exists today.
But the interesting thing about the book is it cuts off before the big success.
Oh, yeah. I think that's a good idea as well.
You know, it's slightly a spoiler, but, you know, I think it's quite admirable that he doesn't say, you know, he doesn't pull an Alan Partridge, needless to say, I had the last laugh.
Yeah.
You know, and then I won, and you know, now I'm going to do the Father Ted Golden Cleric Speech Award about everybody who betrayed me. He just cuts off with a, maybe I should try and make a different kind of record. Kate, what did you think?
Yeah, well, I was trying to work out why this is such an unusual read. It's not really like any other music book I've read. And I think apart from the fact that he cuts off before the massive megastardom, which is a great thing, because actually the earlier part of musicians' lives is always the most interesting bit, the bit that motivated them to do what they did, which you never hear about actually once they've hit international fame. The other thing about it is this extraordinary attention to detail. It's almost a minimalist kind of book. He will talk about the fact that, you know, on some day in 1993 he walked into the shop on 8th Street and he bought an orange for 49 cents from a vegan store and stuff. And you're reading all this stuff and there's something oddly compelling about that extremely mundane detail. And then after a few minutes you think, hang on, he did. How does he know he did that? Of course he didn't. So he's actually got free rein with all the different paraphernalia of his life at that time, the warehouse he was living in, this obsession with food, because obviously as a vegan, he's so limited. Everything's about oatmeal and money and selling, you know, selling an old bit of equipment in order to buy three pots of soya milk. But yeah, I love it when you, there's a writer called Sylvia Smith. She's died now, but it's an East End minimalist writer who wrote a great book called Appleby House in the early 80s about a flat share. And you literally read it in about half an hour because it's so, so mundane.
Yes.
And it's so fascinating.
Well, I thought this struck me as a little bit like Diary of a Nobody. It's kind of Pooter-esque. It's like, but it's, he's wow. not a rock star at all. He's pootling along on the fringes. And even when he's at a sex party, watching people having a threes up and he's trying to play early techno records, he observes it in this very, very wry, detached and extremely funny way. I think it's the kind of book you'll enjoy even if you... never mind not having a particular interest in Moby's music. Even if you actively detest Moby's music, you really enjoy that.
Yes, because that viewpoint carries on into all his early music. So he goes on to Top of the Pops and he says, "My song started, I jumped around, yelled go and whacked the octopad, then it was over." You know, that sums up the anticlimax of it. I mean, often musicians struggle with having to do TV shows when they're used to playing clubs to thousands and thousands of people. And he goes to the shower after. He has a shower and he ends up like kneeling down and praying, basically, and saying, you know, please God, don't let this be it.
Yeah. Well, actually, also, he's very good, I think, at summoning up what it's like to actually make a record. And, you know, we've all read an awful lot of musicians talking about, we had to listen to them talking about the creative process. And I don't think I've come across anybody who does it so well as Moby, because he can make the choice of a chord or a sample or even a particular production approach come alive. He's a proper writer in that respect. And I was genuinely taken into the making of records like Go or records like Why Does My Heart Feel So Bad. I kind of understand how it felt to make that record, which is, when you've been reading about pop music for nigh on 40 years like I have, nice surprise. Yeah. You have to see a different angle to it.
There's an absolute candour, an absolute sort of self-deprecation, I think, that comes through the whole time. And I mean, the vast, vast majority of what, they're not even rock stars, they're quite struggling indie types.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the strongest characteristics is this conceited, delusional sort of that about them. And Moby's the complete opposite of that. I mean, I'm not really much of a fan of his music. And this happens so often, though, I found in the past, that sometimes the most interesting characters aren't necessarily the people that make the most interesting music.
Yeah.
And he is certainly an example of that. I think he's absolutely fascinating.
I'm always just surprised when pop stars can write. I know that sounds funny, you know, I don't know.
Well, you know,
of course,
whether... Herman Melville is supposedly an ancestor of his.
Yeah, exactly. There's that kind of that lineage. But I wonder whether it's different now that, you know, I mean, back in the day, it was that you generally had a ghostwriter. That was what you did. And I think maybe there is more pressure on them nowadays to be able to, particularly with Faber. You know, Brick Smith's book's really good. And it's a massive, great chunk of
Viv Albertine before that as well.
Yeah.
And I think they're probably actively encouraging that kind of...
They're trying to find people who can write first before they sign them up for their story, aren't
absolutely.
They?
Absolutely.
I was going to say, you know, who are our favourite rock autobiographies? I mean, I personally really enjoyed Holly Johnson's A Bone in My Flute and Lydon's No Irish, No Blacks, No Dogs, because they have the similar insight and humour, but also remarkable lives. It helps when you've got good material. Who are our favourite rock biographies?
I mean, Bob Dylan, the first volume of his, God knows where the rest are, but it was the first one of his memoirs. And it was actually, it just goes back to what you were saying, Kate, that just the sheer detail. I mean, when he's, you know, this obviously must be kind of presumably sort of fictional or reconstructed or whatever, of tiny, tiny details of things that happened to him in the East Village in 1961 or whatever. Hmm. And then much more foggy when it comes to the sort of present day. That's the strange thing. But yeah, I think that was tremendous. Hmm. That, and I just wish he'd do more.
I think when musicians write about the early part of their lives, they access a modesty that they may have lost a bit later on. They go right back to the kind of mindset they were in. And I really liked Carrie Brownstein's biography, Sleater Kinney. I don't like Sleater Kinney at all. I've not got no interest in them, but she talks about going along to Evergreen College, you know, the sort of utopian feminist college in Washington where they all started and Riot Girl kicked off. And she just talks about how worthy and miserable Riot Girl was. And she obviously came to kind of represent that scene herself. But she says, you know, I couldn't be myself. There was no sense of humour in it. I felt like this kind of great big goofy. I wanted to be more goofy. I wanted to be more natural. And everything was, you know, you'd have kind of a little post-it note on some bit of food in a student fridge saying, you know, this piece of this company is killing babies in Africa or something, but they were still eating it. And I just thought, you know, you get an access to a kind of a self-deprecation and a modesty that you don't necessarily associate with these musicians through their music or their later life.
Is it the outside world of, you know, people who don't, you know, probably don't pick up quite so many music books as we do, it tends to think that the rock biography is all about tellies being thrown out of windows and things set on fire. Rock depravity is the most boring subject in the world, isn't it? It's all the same It's all cliched. The bands are all imitating what they read in Hammer of the Gods. It's much more interesting when people are talking, as you say, about the boring minutiae, because that's so much more revealing and so much more entertaining.
Yeah, and the fact that Moby has this great bit where he says he doesn't know what rare groove is. He's been told to play at Mars. Yeah. And he's like, oh, God, what's rare groove? He phones everyone up and everyone's saying, well, I don't know, maybe it's James Brown or whatever. And he finally works out it is 70s soul. And he goes along to the record store and he says to himself, well, I'm earning $100 tonight, so I can afford to spend $100 on records. I thought that was just so beautiful. Like, talk about the fact that economically he worked that way, that all his earnings would just go before he'd even done the gig.
I think there's that real sense that there's a total lack of any sense of entitlement. I think that's something that's kind of common to humanity. We all feel like we're kind of frauds to some extent. He feels like, what am I doing in this world? I'm in this world, but I don't really belong in it. I'm a fraud. I'm going to get found out. There's elements of that. But also, I think it's great when he, telling what you were saying, when he meets David Bowie and he says to him, enjoy these years, Moby, you know, isn't life is simpler now. And I think that that's, you know, that's something that these are the best years in a sense that he's written about in the book. I'm not sure I necessarily want to read a book about Moby once, you know, everything's gone sort of stratospheric. Yeah. I don't think we'd be having the same adventures.
Yeah, because success does not really have the dramatic points, does it?
Yeah, yeah.
Who should write their autobiography that hasn't written it yet? I'm holding out for Neil Tennant from the Pet Shop Boys. I think it'd be brilliant. It would be like The Moon's a Balloon. Who would we like to read?
Well, there's actually one that is just about to come out, but it's The Butthole Surfers.
Oh, yes.
And their years. I mean, that is just going to be outrageous, yeah, because, again, there's that kind of combination of, like, you know, that. I mean, Gibby Haynes, I think, has a sort of walk-on part in the Moby book, and I can just imagine that being an absolute rip-roaring, squalid, appalling, sprawling, magnificent read.
Appalling and sprawling, that's a good cover line. So, Moby's Porcelain, available now. A vegan Christian animal rights supporter is probably 100% antimatter to our next subject, the return to TV of Top Gear. Jeremy Clarkson has gone, Chris Evans has taken over, Matt LeBlanc joins as Evans's foil, and the reviews have been mixed, to say the least. The Independent thought it was pointless, hackneyed and tired. Quentin Letts from the Daily Mail complained, surprise, surprise, that it was too politically correct. Ali Ross in The Sun described it as Manchester United with David Moyes. And it took an absolute kicking on social media with under the hashtag of Flop Gear. So before we talk about the return of Top Gear, to get you in the mood, here is a track that they actually played in the first episode. Here is Slow Ride by Foghat. Rock great mates. That was Slow Ride by Foghat, as actually heard on the first episode of the new series of Top Gear. Now, to discuss this massive turning point in British popular culture, we have assembled four people who hate cars and never watched the original series, hate Jeremy Clarkson and would rather be on public transport. Is that fair? Is that a fair description?
I love the original series. Yeah.
So we're all coming to it with an open mind then. Kate, you're a massive petrol head and wearing double denim as we speak. What did you make of the return of Top Gear?
Well, I think that's an important point. It was a show for people who didn't like cars. Mm. And now I feel it's a show about cars.
Right.
This is the problem. They've because they don't have any confidence in the dialogue and the banter, because there isn't any yet, and the entire show was built up on the personality of the three other people who did it. There's very little chat, actually, I thought. There's about 9 challenges. Did you notice this?
Yeah, there's a lot.
They cover the entire planet. One minute they're trying to get to Blackpool and a Reliant Robin, and the next they're in the Sahara Desert in that sort of strange little car that they describe as being like a Cheeto with a saddle on it, which I thought was the one good joke. But I found it very uncomfortable viewing, because I just felt sorry for everybody involved.
Yeah.
Because they're just competing with, I mean, you know, Clarkson fell because of his hubris or whatever, but I think there's a great deal of hubris in the BBC to think that they can do the same show with different people.
Well, I don't know about hubris, it's just that it's a brand juggernaut, the way that global television shows now become. And just saying, well, that was nice, but let's leave it and do something else, is just no longer an option. BBC Worldwide would never wear it, so they've got to carry on. And I actually agree with you. I would never have given Top Gear, you know, the time of day. I watched this and I was kind of pulling for them out of kind of just desperation for them to not make fools of themselves and not fail. David, what did you think of it? as a massive car person.
Well, it's interesting, actually, that you say, I think certainly under Jeremy Clarkson, I always got the feeling that Top Gear wasn't really about cars. It was much more about some sort of British mentality. It was like, you know, up yours, traffic warden, sod you, one-way system, and it was really more about that. And it was, I mean, the idea, you know, the tyranny of political correctness or whatever, and all this nonsense. But I mean, I detest Jeremy Clarkson. I detest everything he stands for. And yet, strangely, whenever I watched it, I actually thought, actually, he's pretty good at this particular thing. It works. He's got a certain dryness. He's got a certain sort of measured self-deprecation. He kind of knows exactly what he's doing. His tone is just right for this show. Chris Evans, I cannot abide Chris Evans. I detest Chris Evans. I really do. It's not as much what he stands for. I just detest him. It really goes back, I mean, to the 90s. And this, there was a real, for me, there were loads of sort of like mid-90s flashbacks about this, from the kind of like ridiculous, you know, use of the Union Jack when they have that race to Blackpool and, you know, that daft race against the Americans. Just this whole kind of braying open mouth sort of tsunami of superlatives. Way, it's amazing. How good is that? It's the best. And I'll tell you where the best, what are the best? The best get better when you go to the, you know, this bloody fighter pilot school or whatever. And I just find him absolutely abominable. He just, to me, we mentioned John Peel. He's the anti-John Peel to me. Witless. I mean, you know, John Peel always had this dry, understated wit. Chris Evans was always kind of braying, sort of ambitious. There was always this kiss up, kick down, you know, obsessed with like the coolness of anybody who was kind of mega rich and mega famous. And yet he was supposed somehow to be a creature of the left field. You know, in the mid-90s, he was the person that would go along and interview Blur and Bjork. And how has it ever come to this? I've never understood his cachet. I've never understood why people describe him as a genius. But you can bray coherently, you know, without stammering.
But I think the BBC have found itself in the archetypal cleft stick, in that Mourinho's rule states, do not follow the person who was really successful. Let, if you can, a scout and a Dutchman go in between and then go in and everything will be fine.
Still hurts, doesn't it, Matt? Still hurts.
But the BBC couldn't afford to do that with Top Gear. They couldn't afford for it to fail abysmally for a season because there's so much riding on it in terms of money and whatever. And then they had to, but the other problem is that I think is a real kind of worry. If I was at the BBC in the top echelons at the moment, I'd be kind of quite worried. Is that they've taken a brand, for whatever you think about Chris Evans, who was hugely successful on Radio 2. You know, he's got kind of 9 million listeners on Radio 2. He's the biggest breakfast show and was doing really well. They've put him in here. He's, for the first time ever, as you say, David, he's getting some stick, which he never did before. You know, the papers loved him before, you know, all through Don't Forget Your Toothbrush, TFI, going right the way back to GLR when he was the kind of hip young thing. And Radio 1, obviously, they loved him. Now they don't. And you kind of look at his Twitter feed at the moment, and it's kind of a little bit worrying. He's putting tweets out which are, fact this was this, fact this got many listeners,
it's fact.
You're kind of going, all of a sudden, they've associated one of their biggest, most successful, most media-friendly brands, and he's getting some stick. And they're stopping News International from going to look to press launches.
Yeah,
I think it just seemed to me was so important with Top Gear and Jeremy Clarkson. I think he had a very precisely calibrated tone. I think he kind of knew what it was doing, and I just think that he's just sort of calamitously wrong for this show as Chris Evans. Yeah, I agree. You know, for all the fact that I dislike him, he does have, he's had the Midas touch, he's had success.
Yeah.
I think Ramsay on at one point as a guest. Yeah. I remember people thinking, hang on, maybe Gordon Ramsay would be pretty good for this.
To me, it feels like Rough Trade have gone to Robbie Williams and said, you know, Jarvis isn't making music anymore, but would you like to go around as Jarvis and tour as Jarvis and sing like Jarvis? And Robbie Williams going, oh, okay, that's quite a good gig. And of course it doesn't work because it's a completely different person. It's like one brilliant DJ versus somebody who was actually a very good presenter in Clarkson.
Well, also it's the mechanics of the thing. You know, Evans, if you look, what his whole career has been based on previously has been live.
Yeah.
You know, everything he's done that has been a success has been live. And it's that adrenaline and kind of that teetering on the edge. All of a sudden, he's presenting a pre-recorded show that is edited, and you know from experience, if you've been on a live show, you get that kind of knot of tension and fear in your stomach, which drives it on, you know. Mm. And also the feeling is that it's as soon as it's gone, it's gone.
Yeah. And the writing's not there. I mean, Matt LeBlanc had better lines, but it's not like he's making those.
Danny Kelly is co-writing this show.
Really?
Yeah. And, you know, Danny Kelly is a good writer and he's very, very kind of experienced in this kind of thing. And I actually think it felt forced and it felt...
The opening joke, I mean, the whole catering joke at the beginning just felt like... And then he says, oh, perhaps it was a bad idea to have questions from the audience now. I think it was a bad idea for an opening joke.
Matt LeBlanc was pretty good, though, wasn't he?
I thought
he came across really, really well, very likable. And one of the nice things about it, he sort of projected this slight impression that, like, what the hell am I doing here?
Yeah.
What is this cockamamie routine?
He just had that automatic injection of sort of Hollywood sort of sparkle. And I almost wish that they would be so confident as to give the whole thing over to, I don't know, Kelsey Grammer or something like that. Just give it to the Americans because they're obviously trying to sell it to
American
Niles
market. Crane, for that matter.
Niles and, you know, Kelsey.
Yes,
but I think it was the first show. So next week there's going to be a
Charlene Spiteri
rating disaster. Jesus. But, you know, the headlines will be rating disaster, whatever, whatever. But I think that, you know, by the end of the series, I think it'll have settled in and, that, you know, they'll have got comfortable within their own skin, which they weren't maybe that first one.
And it's underreported that actually towards the end of Clarkson and the other two series, the ratings were pretty on the fade anyway.
Well, that's the other thing. People talk about ratings and make comparisons, but they're all a bit spurious because, I mean, it's more about share, isn't it?
I mean,
fewer and fewer people are watching telly and there's more and more things to watch. So, you know, I think some of those ratings comparisons are a bit unfair.
Where did this punishment beating from the press come from? Because they've been I've never known a show.
It was such a long build up.
Yeah, I mean, they were gunning for it from...
This is this weird thing. I actually couldn't believe it only just started. I've been reading about this bloody series for months and months and months.
Yeah.
It's a bit like, you know, William Woolard starting in 1977. It's a bit like the papers banging on about it in 1975.
You know?
William Woolard soon. That was bizarre. And I think that, you know, it could possibly be a classic thing of just hoping for a bit of a tumble.
Yeah.
Is it just any stick to beat the BBC with? Because
that's a large part of it.
Yeah, I mean, there is, of course.
A lot of people in Britain had no problem at all with Clarkson's slightly dodgy views, and this is a way of standing up for that. It's like, we love that.
Would they have had any problem with being punched in the face by their employer in a restaurant?
I know.
Because the people who signed petitions saying, bring back Clarkson, he's a legend, they don't really seem to have a riposte
about that.
To that.
No.
Maybe that's why, this is odd, you know, when he said Quentin Letts said it was too politically correct.
I know, because they had
exactly
a woman driver.
The Riot Girl canteen, was it? It was, but I think maybe he was. He maybe thought that because it didn't have that kind of sly Jeremy Clarkson element to it, that they got rid of that, in his mind, sanitised it.
If you look at that first show and you say what was really missing was snide remarks about Moroccans, and
that wasn't particularly the problem.
It's a lesson to us, that we want that back.
Anyway, let's execute a terrifying high speed donut and change direction with the squeal of tyres to the Monkees, who have just released their first album in 20 years. Good Times does what it says on the tin. It's 13 tracks of sunny feel-good pop. It's produced by Adam Schlesinger of Fountains of Wayne, and the late Davy Jones even appears on the record on Love to Love, written by Neil Diamond. There are new songs by Rivers Cuomo of Weezer, Noel Gallagher and Paul Weller, and this one by Monkees' disciple Andy Partridge of XTC. This is You Bring the Summer. And You Bring the Summer. You can really hear the Andy Partridge there. We were playing Spot the XTC bits there. The curse of Wikipedia, one website said this song was co-written by Andy Partridge of the Swedish punk band XTC. And I would listen to the Swedish punk band XTC if they were available. What did we think of Good Times, the return of the Monkees? Kate?
I had mixed feelings about it. I sometimes can't work out the point in records like this, but then at the same time, I think that they're really, really good attempts to capture the soul of the original band, and I think that's worked. The songs that really worked for me actually were the ones that, you know, how you listen to the new ABC album,
yes,
and those songs are new, but they're written with the DNA of songs of 1983. It's not just about the production, it's about the chord changes and the way that they're structured, and it's kind of magic that somebody, it's like cracking open a time capsule basically.
Yeah.
So there's a couple of tracks on here. There's a Carole King and Jerry Goffin one called I Was Not Born to Follow, and there's a Peter Tork one which sounds, Little Girl, which sounds a bit like one of those old Gordon Lightfoot songs from the late 60s that just kind of meanders in all sorts of strange directions, and I thought those were really, really good because they kind of took you back to the time that the Monkees started. I mean, I was sort of, that was nice.
Oh, terribly non-committal there. David, what do you think of that?
I thought I was going to feel more of that. I enjoyed it much more than I expected. I mean, I think it's probably one of those albums, if I'd been reviewing it, I might have given it like three and a half or four stars, then never listened to it again, but because it's probably not particularly my thing. But yeah. I was charmed by it, actually. Mm. It's funny, I was recently sort of surfing around YouTube and I came across this Old Monkeys episode that features Julie Tippett, of all people, and it's clearly some sort of this kind of like high priestess, and it's clearly some sort of parody of The Prisoner, and they're all being kind of brainwashed. But, I mean, the thing, apart from the daftness of all that, what occurred to me is that, especially, maybe not so much David Jones, but the rest of them, they all look absolutely timeless. These are sort of timeless-looking, grungy-type kids that, you know, that any festival in the 1990s, any festival, you know, like last year or even next year, you'll find, especially sort of Americans, walking around like that. There's a sort of timelessness.
They all look like Wallowitz from The Big Bang Theory.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. There's a timelessness about the Monkees. I mean, they really are. They're obviously sort of regarded because they were created the band for TV and comedy. They're almost like barely one step on from the Partridge Family or something like that. And there's ridiculousness of Jimi Hendrix once playing with the Monkees. But actually, Jimi Hendrix probably wouldn't have minded playing with the Monkees. Mm. I think he would have had enough now to actually respect that there is actually a cause, something really kind of. There is something really decent, right? They're quite non-threatening.
Yeah.
But musically, they do represent something wonderfully kind of halcyon about the 60s. And I guess that one of the reasons why it's attracted all of these kind of songwriters, you know, Andy Partridge and whoever, is that you can almost like, you know, they themselves are kind of retrospectively kind of reading the 60s in their own music. And, you know, and they're able to kind of feed back their own sort of refraction of all of that. And I think that's what's really charming and sweet about the album. There was some of the more whistle moments of where they've actually overlaid original tracks, you know, from 67 and 68.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the one title track is based around a Harry Nilsson demo, isn't
that's
it?
Right.
And it's actually got him singing on it.
Yeah, that's right.
Which I got a bit frustrated about, annoyed about, because I really, really like Harry Nilsson. I'd really like to hear that original demo without Mickey Dolenz singing on top of it. But then I thought, actually, if you're going to have songwriters on there, I'm almost more happy to hear Neil Diamond, who wrote for them when in their first incarnation, and Harry Nilsson, who wrote Cuddly Toy. And so that kind of worked. But I felt sometimes that some of the tracks were reminded me most of all of Gimme Some Money by the Thamesmen from this Final Tap film.
I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think that's
I'm getting an earworm with that.
Yeah.
Now.
Well, I was like David. I was very surprised at how much I liked this. I found it a really likable record, and in a way, it is.
But it is a pastiche, though, isn't it?
What is it? Because that's who they
that's
are.
That's the whole kind of quandary about the money. Are they pastiche? Are they serious?
What is authentic is what sounds good. I mean, the division between for real and artificial, I mean, who cares? We had this debate decades ago. It doesn't really matter.
But surely when you start pastiching a pastiche, photocopying a photocopy, in the end, you will just have this
interesting and daring in actually the use of the original tracks and then the overlay of that. I think it was actually kind of cleverly sort of, you know, referencing what's frankly going on. I mean, there are a lot of people that are still making albums from that era, from the 70s and early 80s, and they're just not charming in this particular way because they're just people who've clearly sort of sat in their own kind of hermetic little bubble all this time and refused to take on board any sense of it's now the 21st century in any way. Yeah. I mean, this shamelessly doesn't. I mean, there's no, or they do something embarrassing like do try and do something 21st century, and then that's even worse.
Yeah, that's
true. I mean, with this, you get a real sense of it being, you know, in this kind of time capsule, but they do it in such a kind of interesting, referential, enthralling, charming way. The one track I thought didn't work, inevitably, was the Noel Gallagher.
Exactly.
And then there was a bit that sounded like it was about to become All I Really Want to Do by the Birds. I thought, I bet that's Noel's.
It sounds like a pastiche of Day in the Life as well. The idea that if you're going to do a late 60s slightly psychedelic record, you have to put all these different chunks together and then it just fades out really quickly. And I suppose for me, I thought that it was. I remember reading an interview and one of them said something like, oh, that my wife and daughter are really chuffed that we've got a Weezer song on here. And I thought, it's this amazing kind of back-scratching exercise, isn't it? Like, for people like Noel and Paul, it's a great honour to write for the Monkees, and for them, they're just,
God. Is it a great honour? I mean,
I think so. I think it is, I think it is. I mean, the Monkees are hugely loved.
I mean, people always have a very condescending attitude towards feel-good music. I mean, feel-bad music is always considered somehow more heavyweight and worthy of commanding greater respect. And I think there's a far In some ways, you know, you could say that being cool in the gang or Earth, Wind & Fire, I mean, making music that lifts people or sort of great sort of luminous pop music is a real, real gift, and it should be actually be respected rather than condescended to.
Yeah, I mean, anybody can bang out the minor chords and say, me birds left me, can't they? Which is the lowest common denominator. But one thing, you know...
Rock music's going to enjoy the fate of its twilight retrospective years lasting for decades and decades longer than the actual sort of, you know, halcyon period.
Well, we did think that, you know, it's 2016, and we did think that, you know, the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and Dylan would have been history by the end of the 90s, didn't we? This was, you know, we had no idea people would last for so long.
I was watching an episode of Blossom the other day, 1991, and they're trying to get tickets for the Stones, and she goes like, Dad, I think it's going to be their last gig.
I remember, like, in the late 70s, Tom Robinson, you know, saying, you know, the Stones just split up, they're no longer valid, you know, it's 1978, make way for the Tom Robinson band. Yeah, that happened.
Why, just in conclusion, why do we think the Monkees are so loved? Is it just because they're part of everyone's childhood because of the TV show, or is it something else?
But that hasn't, you know, that's an interesting thing, because they haven't been on TV for 20 years at least. That was part of our childhood when every summer holiday they used to run them all day in the school holidays.
Yeah,
I think, but that hasn't happened for ages.
Not for about 10 years. Yeah, I mean, it was about 10 years, really. Yeah, so they're part of my childhood, but certainly not, you know, I wouldn't remember them in 1967, but probably, the reruns, things like that, would have, like, gone well into the 70s.
Yeah. Kate, did you see the Monkees on rerun as a kid?
No, I never saw it, but I think that because the feel-good element is so strong there, and there isn't this, like we were saying, there isn't this deeply tragic...
But it's going to be that same thing as where I got really excited when the Banana Split, when I found a Banana Splits episode on YouTube and thought, this is going to be fantastic, my childhood. And you watch it and go, oh dear. You know, and they're releasing the Monkees series on DVD to coincide with this album. And I think people will get it, go, fantastic, put it in, and they go.
And after a while. Yeah.
Right. Okay.
They did that with the Glen Campbell Good Time Hour, which I think is great. But it is, you know, you watch it and it's basically they're sort of sitting on the backs of hippos with the Smothers Brothers. And, you know, and then introducing Linda Ronstadt for 2 minutes. It's sort of...
How have I not seen this?
An innocent time.
But I think that's the charm of these things. When the older telly gets, the more you don't want to see the exciting smash cuts and, you know, drone shots of today's TV. You want to see the stuff that is kind of slower and in some respects more boring, but in other respects more revelatory of the time.
And the good-natured things that pop stars do when they're starting out as well.
Yeah. Okay, so we're coming up to the end of the show, and as ever, we're going to wind up with closing time chatter, where our special guests tell us about something they just can't wait to pass on from the world of pop culture. So if they've been reading, hearing, seeing. David, what's your closing time chatter?
Yeah, I was going to talk about, I think it's either out now or just coming out, it's a book by David Toop called Into the Maelstrom, and it's his history of, like, the early period of, like, free improvised music, which I think is an absolutely fascinating sort of subcultural phenomenon in the UK. Because if you live where I live, around sort of East London, Hoxton, Shoreditch, and there's lots of tiny little venues where these kind of music is put on, and you've got these kind of, you can kind of walk into the basements of art galleries and people like that, and places like clubs like the Clinker and people like that, or Scale Down, and there's all these kind of veteran free improvisers, people like Sylvia Hallett and Steve Beresford. They're still playing to audiences of about 10 or 15 people. Quite often they're just the other musicians on the bill.
Yeah.
And, you know, making this kind of free improvised music, you know, using, I don't know, anything from little wine glasses to various bits of domestic hardware to sometimes occasional musical instruments, you know, in this kind of wonderful kind of exploratory neo-Dadaist type spirit. It's obviously, I think it's something that really began in the late 60s, to the whole free improv scene, you know, and there were people like... AMM, for instance. And what's fascinating about this scene is it's incredibly esoteric, it's incredibly tiny, it's continuous, and yet, in its past, it's had these kind of bizarre sort of interfaces with popular culture. So, I mean, AMM, for instance, you know, Paul McCartney was a big fan of AMM, and I think that, like, some of that kind of avant-garde sensibility sort of fed into, and they play this kind of just absolutely sort of atonal, free-ranging sort of, you know, improvised music on various sort of, you know, sort of jazz stroke classical type vibe. Paul McCartney was deeply influenced, and he actually sort of participated in the audience by rolling a kind of old tuppenny bit up and down a radiator, contributing to the general kind of melee of noise. And there was even talk at one point of the guitarist, Keith Rowe in AMM, taking Sid Barrett's place in Pink Floyd, you know. And then later on he had things like the Flying Lizards, Money, and people like Steve Beresford were involved in that.
Yeah.
And that was like number one single. Then later on groups like Frank Chickens and...
So keep an eye out for Toop's book. What's it called again?
Into the Maelstrom.
Excellent. Okay. Kate, what's your closing time chatter?
I'm interested in the rise of board games. Oh, apparently board games are earning more money on Kickstarter than most of the other things you expect to earn money on Kickstarter, like, I don't know, people's albums and things like that. And there's this giant expo this weekend in Birmingham in the NEC, 4-day expo.
Really?
Where they're apparently, there's one company, I can't remember what they're called, but they commission all these kind of super geniuses to create these board games. And I don't know if you've noticed, did you know about Meetup, the Meetup groups in across the country where you sort of like sign up for some weird hobby that you have. But these Meetup cafes are exploding everywhere, which are board game cafes. So you can go along and like there's a couples board game night in Kentish Town somewhere.
Oh,
where I think it's kind of trying to get away from the idea that board games are played by nerdy guys. So you go with your girlfriend and then you maybe you double date over a board game. But I'm fascinated by the fact that you can create new games, because if you think about it, you've got like 8 notes in a scale and people still are able to write new songs.
Yeah.
It's a bit like that with games, isn't it? Like,
there are certain logical rules.
Rules. But then you hand over the game really to the people who are playing it, which is such a strange, I don't know, it's a strange exchange.
We got given one the other day, a couple of years ago, and it's a totally new board game, and I'd never seen it before. And we got given it for our kids, and it's fantastic. It's called Attack on Meeple Town or something. It's basically what happens is you build a town with all these skyscrapers in, and there are these tiny little figures, and there's doctors, and there's people in the army, and they're all exactly the same. They look like little wooden figures, and then basically you get these. Each player is a different type of dinosaur or monster, kind of Godzilla thing, and you essentially flick these Godzillas around the board, destroying all the people and destroying all the buildings.
So it's basically Cretaceous Subutio, is what you're saying.
Fantastic.
That's amazing.
I'm sure 20 years ago they said that these things, you know, no one's going to be interested in these things because of computers, and I think it's almost actually because of computers that they are interested.
Well, there's the National Video Game Arcade in Nottingham, which is kind of quite near to where I live. And they now do a weekly, in their cafe, a weekly board game event for people to come in. So, yeah.
Well, I just did Mark Moore of S-Express for The Guardian a couple of weeks ago, and he's a board game nut, and Raddatz has loads of board games. So, your superstar DJs are into them as well.
I really want to learn how to play Dungeons & Dragons, but it's too much of a mountain to climb.
Oh, was that a joke?
Hold off. My closing time chatter is, if you can get a copy of this week's big issue, do. The one dated May 20th to 5th of June, with Create Activism on the front, because there is the most fantastic half-man, half-biscuit feature inside. And it's a lovely read because it just doesn't do any of the things you expect from music journalism. It talks to the band, but it also talks to the fans. It's really about what attracts people to this, you know, in some respects, you know, pretty unprepossessing band. There's a guy who says, "My life is football, Morris dancing and half man, half biscuit," says Tony Roberts, "biscuitier." And it's just the most beautiful portrait of a band who don't expect success, never even want success, won't play outside of Britain because they don't want to sleep in beds that are not their own. And it's just absolutely a beautiful picture of people ploughing their own furrow and doing their own thing.
Don't they cycle to the gigs as well in a little group?
I don't know about that.
The biscuit fans.
It's usually Firkin Ed Van High. Oh, the fans.
Yeah,
I'm sure the fans do, yes. In high-vis jackets with their Joy Division oven gloves.
Didn't they cancel an appearance on the Tube once because Tranmere Rovers were playing
they
that
did,
night?
Yes, they did, yes. That was their defining moment.
Yeah.
That was their Elvis hips moment.
All I want for Christmas is the Duke of Prague away kit.
Aye. Matt, what's your... Come on, you finally... We've had requests from Matt to do a closing time chatter. Go ahead, Matt.
From anyone who knows me. Preacher, the new TV series, which is based on the comic by Garth Ennis, which is now, the first episode is up on Amazon Prime, and it's been really interesting to see how Seth Rogen has been able to take a comic which involves vampires, the son of God, angels, explosions, and turn it into what looks like it could be a really good new box set craze.
Excellent. Okay. So... that's our show. Thank you for joining us. We'll be back with another Big Mouth next week with more special guests and more high-quality blather about pop culture. Thank you to our guests Kate Mossman of The New Statesman and David Stubbs of The Guardian and When Saturday Comes. Remember, you can hear this show again as a podcast, and you can hear all our past shows as well on our Audio Boom channel. Just go to audioboom.com and search for Big Mouth. You can also subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. Just go to the podcast section of iTunes and search for Big Mouth. And you can read Big Mouth stuff too. If you go to our Facebook page, facebook.com/BigMouthUK, you can see original features, new interviews, and all kinds of actual real-life handmade journalism. So thank you for listening, and we'll see you again next week. Bye-bye.